sometimes can find themselves asking this question. What would my life be like if I was in better shape? If we fit into more traditional expectations of fitness and beauty, would we be more successful as entertainers, musicians, or comedians? Just how far will a six-pack of abs take me in life?
Our guest today is comedian Cody Melcher, who hosts the brilliant podcast Tomefoolery, a great show about bad books. Cody just taped a podcast looking at the Christian diet book, Help Me Lord, The Devil Wants Me Fat, by the Reverend Dr. C.S. Lovett. Join us as we chat about this crazy book and the unrealistic expectations we have about our bodies.
Plus, a Mexican talk show hosted by a clown, Platanito, features comedian Mateo Lane lip-syncing for his life.
Scientists discover the world's oldest living land creature is gay.
Which states have the best Halloween candy?
And happy birthday to the iPod. It's now 16 years old.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Did you know that rainbows come from unicorns? Well, they do. They really, really do. And I've got just the t-shirt to prove it. Get yours today at feastoffun.com/store.
Our guest today is comedian Cody Melcher, who hosts the brilliant podcast Tomefoolery, a great show about bad books. Cody just taped a podcast looking at the Christian diet book, Help Me, Lord, The Devil Wants Me Fat, by the Reverend Dr. C.S. Lovett. Welcome back to Feast of Fun.
Thank you for having me.
This may be the last podcast we tape with you before you move to Los Angeles.
This will definitely be the last one before I move, because I'm moving in 10 days.
And he's like, and I'm not coming back here.
I know. I love you both, but my apartment is literally a hoarder maze right now in terms of the move, and I'm just not going to have time for anything other than nervous breakdowns and moving.
Did you move the piano yet?
Yeah, they took the piano on Saturday.
You have a red baby grand piano that was auctioned by Elton John.
It was he sold 20 pianos for his AIDS charity, and I purchased one of them. So
I just had to have one. I don't know how to play.
It plays itself. You don't need to learn to play.
Oh really?
Yeah,
it's a player piano.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
It's got like a little hookup underneath it.
Does it just play Elton John songs?
No, but he did specially record some, so it uses his actual finger strokes for the songs.
Ooh, you're getting fingered by Elton John.
Oh right. Oh boy.
I guess that's why they call it the blues.
They took it on Saturday.
Cody, let me play with your ivories a little bit more. Let me tickle them, yeah.
After they took it, I realized that I did not get any paperwork from them. And so part of me is worried that it was an elaborate piano theft.
Oh, geez.
I'll find out in a month if I ever get it back.
Did you get an email or anything?
Well, it's like I emailed the moving company, and we signed a whole contract and everything. But then a different person contacted me about the move. But that could have just been someone who intercepted an email and stole my piano.
Oh, my God. Googling like piano,
piano thieves.
Yeah.
So if you see a red baby grand on a truck on the freeway, pull them over and do a citizen's arrest.
I mean, luckily, although I don't know how this would work if it got on the black market. I don't know how that happened.
You can buy it back on eBay.
Well, I mean, the lucky thing is that because there's only 20 in the world, it has a specific serial code number to it. So if it did get stolen and someone found it, it would be easy to prove it's mine because the company has my name registered as the owner of that piano.
Detective Elton John is on the case.
I would love to watch a Murder, She Wrote with Elton John. I mean, he looks about Angela Lansbury at this point.
David, get me my thinking cap on.
Cody, why does the devil want us fat?
Yeah.
This is the most buck wild part about it. So it's all predicated on the concept that putting anything before Christ is because Satan is trying to lure you away from Christ's love. Mm-hmm. So essentially, if you're eating so much that you're overweight, because the whole book is predicated on the concept that if you're overweight, it's because you're eating too much.
Because the devil wants you fat.
Yeah. He discusses glandular issues, but says it's too small of a percentage. So
the devil's thick and juicy.
And that is mostly the case. We all understand that. You're fat because you're taking in too many calories.
Yeah. And also fat is a relative term. Also, sizes of frames, which he even acknowledges in his sizing thing. It's weird. But But so the concept is that you're too gluttonous. Like one of my favorite lines in the book was he's contemplating the fact that because he used to be overweight before he wrote the book, and he was contemplating that his size had increased his lethargy and decreased his zest for the Lord, and that was the devil, because by making us gluttonous and making us overweight, it makes us more tired and less willing to celebrate God's love and be closer to Jesus, because you can't be close to Jesus if you're putting a chicken wing between you.
You know, with self-help programs and 12-step programs, there's a acronym that's HALT. Have you ever heard about this?
I have not.
That you're more likely to relapse into your drug addiction or self-destructive behavior when you're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And yes. I add horny.
Okay.
So horngry.
HALT.
Horngry. You basically, it puts you in a state of mind that you're not making the best decisions for your well-being.
Right.
And so maybe, you know, the Reverend Doctor, he is sort of tie into this idea that to live your best life possible, you got to nourish your body, nourish your soul, and take care of yourself.
A little bit. There's also
what's wrong with that?
Well, because there's two things, and then also the other flip side of it is that it turns out in the end of the book really why he wants you to get in shape is because he wants you to be hot so that people go, hey, you're really hot. And you can go, thank you. It's because of God's love. Let me tell you about him. And then it's an entry. It's an entry point to getting you to evangelize people. Yeah. So it's one of my favorite lines on the show. One of the guests, Dave Stinton, said it's a thirst trap for Jesus. Is literally you're trying. He wants you to be like a bauble to lure people into Christ's love.
I could see it happening.
Because he wants you to be fit and attractive. That's a reoccurring thing. And it's because he wants people to come up to you and ask you why you're so fit and attractive.
Well, a lot of those Instagram studs, those bodybuilders, video bloggers who are known for their fitness, also love to dispense self-help advice.
Sure.
And sometimes, you know, the self-help advice it sounds off a lot like Christian propaganda.
Yeah.
Those inspirational quotes. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's a religion of you, you know?
Those aphorisms, those things that'll help you get through the
spiritualism, day. Spiritualism. There's some sort of, because you got to replace it with something, I guess.
Well, and also, too, is because, you know, when you're just so focused on the body, a lot of people view that as being very kind of shallow.
Yeah.
And so you want to be like, hey, listen, I have another dimension to me, which is all these pithy sayings.
I have another shallow dimension below that.
Christians who put out, literally make parodies of those things. Mm-hmm. And there's instead of Gold's Gym, it's God's Gym.
Oh, clever.
His pain is your gain.
Well, but the Reverend does have some good advice, because, you know, in religion, a lot of religious sects, they go into fasting as a way to sacrifice, right? And so, and he uses fasting as a way to actually lose weight.
Yes. So what you have to do is you have to first tell Satan he has no control over you, because you can't start. You can't
you say,
start
not
the process.
Today, Satan.
He literally gives you like things.
Not today.
He gives you actual like paragraphs. You have to yell at the devil, and he wants you to shout loudly at the devil, Motley Crue style. Yes, and then. You have to do that. Then you have to go to the fast. So here's the problem that we have. So he wants you to do a 10-day fast where you're only drinking water, which is a little dangerous.
That's extreme.
He also later in the book tells pregnant women that they can fast, which is not probably a good idea.
No.
He also tells you that your doctor is knowledgeable, but also doesn't know everything because they don't know the Lord. And so you should listen to God over your doctor.
What about Christian Reverend doctors like CS?
He's not a medical doctor.
Oh.
He has an honorary doctorate.
He has back from the National Enquirer.
That's, you know, in dieting now and in health lifestyle, fasting is a big thing, and they call it intermittent fasting, whereas like you try and get all of your meals within a 6-hour time period or 8-hour time period, and the rest, so you would have a meal like, let's say, 6 o'clock at night, and you don't have your next meal until like noon, so you would skip breakfast, you would have no snacks, and they say it actually does really a lot of it's good for your health, because it reduces your calorie intake, it gets your body to burn fat, but also too that fasting makes your body release human growth hormone, which helps repair your body.
Right. And Mark, have you practiced that?
It's hard. I get so hungry.
Hungry.
One of the guests on the show actually does do intermittent fasting as well. Mm-hmm. And that's also like if you're aware, you're healthy about it, mm-hmm. and you also are, you know, in contact with your doctor mm-hmm. about it. The problem with this is that not only does it walk you down the line of your doctor doesn't really know everything he's talking about, mm-hmm. and he even tries to tell you that your doctor will try to scare you into mm-hmm. thinking fasting's bad. So it's this very mm-hmm. it's that weird problem of listen to me over any other person that sure. you're talking to.
And that's the nature of a lot of these kind of religious cults, mm-hmm. is yes. that they want to believe I'm the authority, nobody else is the authority, because right. they want to have control over right. you.
It's also this element of fear, mm-hmm. you know, that he's adding to, which in this book is like, okay, it's just about dieting. But the most recent book that came out in 2016, which is authored by him, but he died in 2012, so I don't really know exactly how that worked out.
Posthumously
but
published.
That one is hardcore. Society is falling apart. Israel is under attack. Christians will be put in slave camps. You need to prepare for the end times. So it's a very end-timey group already.
Okay.
So it does still introduce that concept of constant fear that the devil is trying to destroy you. And so that's a little rough, where it's like you can't even watch television without like being worried that the devil's going to like try to ruin your relationship.
I guess it must appeal to some people that have some kind of paranoia, or maybe like, you know,
yeah,
some kind of mental health issues, because they're just like they're always looking for something out to get them.
Right. I think it's just answers for what's going wrong yeah. with them that isn't them or isn't just randomness. Because
sure.
randomness is just as scary to them. And so at least this gives them a reason. Mm. But yeah. So at the end of the book, he then gives. So after the fast, you then just return to a healthy diet in Christ's love. And the diet part's actually not that bad. Like it actually gives you really healthy diet advice. So if you want to read.
You do like brown rice and vegetables for Jesus, don't you?
Like, yeah, like, no, yeah, and it's like cut out, you know, white flour and white sugar and stuff like that. You know, refined, you know, corn syrups and stuff. But so it has some good dieting tips. So if you want to read the book for just that last third, go for it. But probably not the
bookmark
first.
This, guys. Future episode is the bizarre and twisted history of junk food in America and around the world.
Mm. Is it Satan?
No, actually, it's the nuclear bomb invented junk food.
But I was hoping to undercut it by just being Satan.
It's not Satan. It's a nuclear bomb.
Or Satan's behind everything, though, isn't he?
Yeah, no, yeah.
I like the idea that you can just yell at Satan and he'll just go away.
Yeah, well, because you have the control.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you will have power over Satan.
And that kind of comes from like a lot of old mythology. It's like when you have like those jingle bells at Christmas, mm-hmm. and that's those bells are supposed to scare away demons and devils.
Yeah,
it works.
Plus, like grotesques and gargoyles as well. Like mm-hmm. they're supposed to scare away evil spirits.
Demons is a state of mind, and if you think optimistically, if you get happy, if you enjoy where you are and what you're doing, most of the beasts of burden will dissipate like clouds in the morning sun. And this is one thing that we started talking about this because we're talking about the challenges that gay men face when developing careers in entertainment.
Yes.
And then part of it is like this idea that if I had a six pack abs, I probably would do better. And certainly we've seen some, gay male comedians who work out of the gym and suddenly they become more popular or vice versa. We've seen that with straight comedians, mm-hmm. Joe Pesci.
Joe Piscopo.
Piscopo.
Yeah.
But it was reversed, wasn't
he
it?
Became a bodybuilder, and then suddenly he wasn't funny. And somebody said that to me, and they're like, Fausto, I'm worried as you put on more muscle that you'll stop being funny. And I said to them, I was like, don't worry, I was never funny to begin with.
I think it can help straight guys as well. I mean, if you look at, Chris Pratt was already doing well on Parks and Rec, but when Chris Pratt got hot, it added a whole level on top of it. So
is he funny, though?
I think Chris Pratt's hilarious, yeah.
No, I mean, funnier... I don't think it's about athletic
him.
Man.
I don't think it's about him being funnier or less funny. I think it's that he's funny. He's now funny and also hot.
Mm.
That he used to be funny in spite of not being hot, and now like in terms of people liking him, following him. If you look at social media, half of the content about him is about how people wish that like he was their boyfriend or husband.
Mm.
And that has to do with his comedy as well as his attractiveness. And when we're talking about social media, it's not about the actual comedy or being on stage. It's about your presence on social media. So it's not only the humor you're putting into Twitter, but also like your pictures on Instagram and things like that. And so I think they work in tandem. So yeah, I think people who put funny
photos of themselves like flexing at the gym to get a little attention for their comedic projects is deplorable.
What douchebags? Who does stuff like that? But you know, it's like you post a picture of yourself and whatever, you know, it doesn't get many likes, but you do it flexing, and then all of a sudden it's just like ooh.
Yeah.
We just did a successful Kickstarter for Cooking with Drag Queens, mm-hmm. and Trixie Mattel brought this out there in our interview with her, right?
Yeah.
She said, "It's like, why don't you put some nude pics?"
And I have to tell you, Fausto mentioned it, and somebody wrote to me. He's like, Fausto said he'd put yours out there. How much do I, for $70, you said you'd send him a nude?
I said for generous donations. Don't be, not a $5 and you get to see my ass. Mm-hmm. What the fuck is that shit about?
What if you made it like reward tiers, where it's like you get like the base of the shaft for this much, then you get... You get a little bit more of the penis as it goes, you know, and like you, to get to the tip.
Well, Foster, there'd be only two tiers.
Oh man. Did the sun go behind a cloud? What happened?
I'm just kidding. It's normal size.
That's what people with small penises say.
No, it's not. It's not.
Look, every penis is beautiful. Every penis is equally beautiful and horrifying.
Because as gay men, we think about each other on a sexual level. Mm-hmm. With everyone we meet, mm-hmm. you know, and we're men too, mm-hmm. and we're every person we meet, we put them in the category I want to fuck them or I don't want to fuck them.
Right. I mean, it's a joke I make on stage as well. Is part of the problem, part of the reason why I have body issues and a lot of gay men have body image issues, is because it's the same male gaze that we apply on other people, but the call's coming from inside the house, like. When you objectify your own gender, you kind of are also objectifying yourself in certain ways, and so that's why that's such a rampant problem. And so the problem is, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not necessarily a great thing. I mean, a lot of because I do a lot of stuff on YouTube now, and I get around and on a lot of different projects, mm-hmm. and I'll notice that there are a fair number of people. Of other gay men who do like what I do, but they also will comment a lot about like how cute I am. Aww. And things like that. And I don't find that, and I'm not hurt by that or turned off by that necessarily. But it is interesting to me in a way that like when you look at like you know like a female like a woman comedian or something where it's like. You'll see a lot of that too, where it's like they can't just do a project, and you don't see that as much with straight men.
It's not the content; they're not commenting the content. Right. They're talking about your sexual desires. Right. So female comedians are like, "Oh my god, what a great rack!" or "She's hot," or something
right,
like that.
Right.
Or I wouldn't fuck her. But,
right.
You know.
And they might mention the comedy as well, but you don't mm-hmm. see that with like a lot of straight men. You don't go like a straight man's YouTube video of their mm-hmm. stand up and see a lot of women commenting, "Man, he's really hot." You know, like
well, Greg Kinnear and. Dane Cook, and the other guy who replaced Greg Kinnear on Talk Soup.
Oh,
they were all sort of known for their sexual attractiveness as well as for their comedic
talents. Greg Kinnear, the guy.
He used to be the original host of Talk Soup.
Greg Kinnear?
Yes, yeah. Man.
The guy from that movie with Matt Damon where they were conjoined twins?
Yes.
Why is that the first movie I think of for Greg Kinnear? poor Greg Kinnear. He's better than that.
Like, and where is he now?
I love Greg Kinnear. Mm-hmm. I think he's still an attractive man.
Joel McHale.
Yes.
That's it.
You know, and part of it is like, I think the job of an artist, we have to stop thinking ourselves maybe as musicians or as comedians or as media personalities mm-hmm. or as drag queens and really step back and think of ourselves as artists.
Right.
And the reason that I use this very grandiose old world term is because the job of an artist is to cultivate a relationship with their audience. Mm. It's your job to separate the people who are going to be your audience from those who are not.
Right.
Because it's tyranny to demand and pressure the whole world to like you unconditionally.
Mm, sure.
And so
that's for the movie Mother.
Yeah.
We didn't see it. Oh, is it terrible?
It's not good.
But I think that's one of the things that it's really hard to wrap your mind around. And even people who put content. We're all artists to some degree. We're putting content on social media. We're photographing ourselves. We're doing self-portraits, and we're inviting the world to acknowledge mm-hmm. our value based on whether they like that photo of ours. And we equate our value as people based on those pictures we're posting up on the internet.
Right.
And so, you know, no one is going to like you all 100% of the time. Not 100% of the people are going to like you. Mm-hmm. And so if, in terms of liberation, we have to think about the work that we make as cultivating a specific crowd.
Right.
Right. And so when we think about our success in terms of our fitness, our physical fitness, or if I had 6-pack abs, I would have a bigger audience. You're really discounting the value of the content you've made. You're reducing yourself into an object. But, you know,
right.
If putting the dress in the window helps to sell the dress, put the dress in the window, like get your ass to the gym there's value in taking care of yourself.
There's also a cause and effect where it's like, am I devaluing my work because I think that that will help me, or are other people devaluing my work because they think that that's what will help me?
Why not both?
And that's what I'm saying. I think it is both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in order to counteract that, I think you want to, you know, paint with all the crayons in the box. You want to embrace
paint with all the colors of the wind.
Yeah. Pull the finger with all the colors of the wind. It's, you want to be able to. And this is one thing that I get criticized a lot because people think that I'm relying on my body for my success. Hmm. And the podcast abstracts us. You know, most of the audience doesn't even know what we look like, mm-hmm. you know, and they have a different idea of our expectations. If they think like
a lot of times they think we're much smaller people. Yeah. And when they meet us, I'm like, they're like, oh, my God, I thought you were like 5'6".
Oh, wow.
And we're like, really?
Okay. Because we're cute in their eyes. Aww. And cute things in people's minds are small.
Yeah. I'm like 6'4" and they don't mm-hmm. even, you know,
I'm a Keebler elf.
I am a smaller.
I think you're the tallest of us all.
I'm Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
I sleep in a shoebox.
What? No, you're 6'1". What are you?
6'3".
Are you really? Oh, yeah. I'm only 5'11".
I'm as tall. I'm the Goldilocks porridge. Not too tall. Not too short. Not too hard. Not too soft.
I mean, I think the most important thing, if you want to find truth in your art, is to remember that you're a vessel of Christ's love, and
yes.
that Satan can't stop you as long as you are bathed in the light of Christ
and you yell at him to stay away.
Why is it so hard for? And this is one thing I observe in gay bars. Mm-hmm. We really only do drag shows mostly. Mm-hmm. If you think about like lesbian venues or other,
are there lesbian venues anymore? Those are all dying.
Coffee shops or mm-hmm. restaurants in the history yeah. of LGBT culture. We have gay bars, we have lesbian coffee shops,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, very little else, right. theater companies. But
yeah.
generally speaking, the gay guys like the drag queens, and the yeah. lesbians like the beat poets.
Yeah, and the gay folk guys music. Liking the drag queens to the extent that they're liking them now is relatively a new phenomenon. Probably, you know, only since RuPaul's Drag Race has been on the air did people really come out in droves to show up and see drag acts. Before, it was like, you know, you were playing to many times to a very modest crowd.
Yeah, I would say as a performer who has performed like intermittently with drag queens or and especially at gay clubs, I've done a couple of like drag shows where they added comedians in. I'll say that it's two things that I think makes stand up comedy not effective at gay clubs. One is atmosphere. It's just not an atmosphere. And I did a show in Madison, Wisconsin. It was actually the first time I did 45 minutes. And it was a fine audience. They were very nice. They tried really hard, but we were on like the drag queen stage and they had put up like a curtain between the rest of the bar, but then they still had music going and a full gay club happening mm-hmm. on the other side of a curtain that was not. So
it's very distracting.
Yeah. There's a lot of distraction. The sound is not being canceled out. People are wandering in from the bar because they have no idea what's going on over here. So it's occasionally distracting because part of the problem with comedy that a lot of people forget or don't fully understand is that it requires attention and it requires silence on the part mm-hmm. of the audience other than laughter and any mm-hmm. other engagement being asked for. And then that comes to the second part, which is adding atmosphere. So it's also usually later at night. People are also drinking, usually a little more heavily. And gay men typically, you know, I hate speaking in generalities, but this is kind of what we're doing, tend to think that they're the funniest one in the group. And so you get heckled way more by gay men than you do a lot of other groups.
Is that so?
It's like gay men and bachelorette parties. That's kind of it. Like, so I've almost every time I've done a show at a gay club, I've been heckled multiple times by different people.
I wonder why that is.
Because sassiness is kind of built into gay culture mm-hmm. as a concept, and everyone's mm-hmm. kind of got a quip all the time mm-hmm. ready to go. Or they want something they want to say. Also, they're just drinking heavily. If you're at a drag show, usually you're doing like vodka Red Bulls, mm-hmm. especially a lot of them are later at night because people don't really go to gay clubs until later in the evening. Gay clubs don't really start kicking off at like 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock, which is when you want a comedy show. Mm. It's either like 10 or something. People have been pre-gaming because they weren't expecting it. Drag requires some interaction through money. You can yell stuff at a drag queen, you know, respectfully.
You can have a conversation because, like, you know, the music's always going to be louder to you.
That's why
you're
musicians not throw them do better.
Off because it's like, you know, it's pre-recorded and everything.
Yeah, and musicians do better in those situations too, because you can have a music set in an empty room and you're still playing music. Mm-hmm. You can have a music set in a room where everyone's talking and you're still playing music, and some people can still enjoy it because it's usually louder. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing stand-up, no one can be talking in the room.
Yeah.
And if there's no one else in the room, it's a really bad show.
And it's that symbiotic relationship you give to them and they give you back laughter. And
it's a really weird art form mm-hmm. that requires
is much more important to a comedian mm-hmm. than in the state of the room than to other performers.
Right.
And well, if you think about, like, if Mark and I interviewed our guests with these, like, with indifference, sad faces, and there are podcasts out there where the hosts are like antagonistic with the guests mm-hmm. and the guests are like miserable and everybody's miserable and nobody wants to enjoy that.
Yeah.
And you know, they disappear. We call them pod faded. Right. Mm-hmm. And part of it is, like, it's really emotionally difficult to step back mm-hmm. as an audience member or as a host or as a person who's sharing attention with somebody and saying, this person is more deserving of attention than I am mm-hmm. right now. Doesn't mean I'm less valuable of a person just because I'm giving that to somebody else. And it's a hard concept for us to wrap our head around.
Right. And that's mm-hmm. actually a really interesting point, because I think that also kind of plays into the gay club, because I think culturally speaking and personally culturally speaking, when you go to a gay club, especially if you're, you know, younger, it's your chance and time to fully express yourself. And especially if you know, if it's a big city you just moved to, or, mm-hmm. you know, or it's like a local area for a lot of rural people. Mm-hmm. And it's like the one gay club around. It's kind of your time. It's your time to express yourself. It's your time to be who you are. And so, yeah, there might even be a little bit of an interplay where it's like, well, I'm also a person who's here. And I want my voice to be heard. Mm-hmm. It's more of a subconscious mm-hmm. thought, but that you mentioning that kind of made me think that might be part and parcel of the heckling in the gay club.
Stuart was performing in like the backwoods of Tennessee, and somebody from the audience came up and took the microphone and said, "This performance is too unilateral."
Oh yeah.
And it was, and so like, and then I don't know what their whole point was. They wanted to get the audience more involved into it.
Yeah.
And Fausto was just like, he was hosting the show and was like bringing acts on and stuff like
that. Part of it was like, we were in the backwoods of Tennessee and they had hired me to host a you know, musical variety show. I think Bitch and Animal were one of the performers, right? This was not, so the first time we did it after the events of September 11th,
mm-hmm.
it was awesome. We were like, the world is changing. We may not be around next mm-hmm. week. Like, people really felt like there was an urgency to come together as a community. And, you know, it was dangerous to get on an airplane. And we didn't know what was going to happen.
No, like, we didn't even know if we'd be able to fly, because it was literally like the week after or something.
Yeah, the week after September 11th, 2001. And so when we were there, it was like something really special. The second time we did it, it was something very different. So the Michigan Women's Music Festival had attracted a lot of protesters because of their women-born women policy was very short-sighted.
Oof.
And so there was all these gender non-binary, non-conformist individuals, mostly people who were assigned female at birth, who did not want to identify as anything. A lot of them had just had significant plastic surgery done on their bodies. And they were people who were like, you know, had really strong feelings, strong emotions, and we're ready to fight with the world. They're, you know, the wig was on too tight.
Well, a lot of them, you know, they identified as pirates, and their preferred pronoun was "ar."
But I think
I'm not kidding.
I know it sounds like a joke, but and the pirate gender nonconformists were in some ways like mutineers. There were rebels. There were punks. There were anarchists, and they were ready to fight with whoever was there. Mm. And so they showed up to this festival. About 300 people. And this is a festival that usually had about 100 or 200 people. So more than half of the crowd there was ready to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for a fight. And, you know, we're peace-loving hippies. And we're like, cool, man. You want to interrupt my performance? All right, let's do it. You know, this is performance art. Anything can roll, you know. And some of these individuals are really, like, wanting a conflict. And we're just, like, not able to give that to them. And so they were sort of like, they were unhappy because we couldn't have a conflict. And they were unhappy because we had, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
It was a no-win situation with that crowd.
Right.
And ultimately, like, I think and from what I hear, eventually the two communities kind of married each other and grew into something really beautiful. But initially it was a very quarrelsome state.
Right.
And so for me, as like reflecting on that, it was just like, not everybody's going to like what you do. And even people that you like may not necessarily like you in return.
Oh, sure.
I mean, we invite so many people to participate. This is an example. Like, they're like, why isn't this drag queen on Cooking with Drag Queens? And I'm like, because she's threatened by the fact of standing in front of a stove and cooking something.
Mm-hmm. Cooking is scary to people.
We raised $22,000 to do art projects that feature these drag queens. And a lot of these drag queens spend tens of thousands of dollars to create content to stay out there in the world. And for some of them, they totally get it. They want to jump on board. They're awesome. And that's our audience. That's our community.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's other entertainers who just don't get it.
Right.
And that's okay, because you know what? This is not the show for you.
Because what one bitch won't do, another bitch will.
And you know what? It's like we're basically like serving them delicious food that's to their taste, to their interests. We're making them beautiful meals. We're documenting their lives and presenting it out there to the world, to thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And some people just don't get that. And that's okay.
Right. And there's also, I mean, and also generally speaking, not specifically speaking about the show as well, is sometimes it's also just some people, you know, have a more localized focus on their skill set. You know, it's a thing that happens in comedy all the time. One of my friends, Rebecca O'Neill, who's a fantastic comedian, talked about how every time anytime an agent talks to her, they want to know what project she has in mind, like for television or whatever. And she's like, I just want to be a really great stand-up comedian. Like, can we get like a special working or something like that? And they're like, well, we want to find more writing, you know, diverse people. And it's like, okay, but like, why can't I just do stand-up? Or like one of my very close friends in comedy runs a show here at the Laugh Factory, that's a roast show. And I have never done it because it's just they just kind of throw a bunch of comedians together and we have to write jokes, you know, roasting each other. And I only ever feel comfortable doing roast jokes if I actually know the people, because I either have a tendency to go too far if I don't know them, because like I don't know what I can make fun of. So I'll go too deep accidentally because I can see like way too close into their eyes. But I don't like hurting people accidentally. Mm-hmm. And I also only enjoy roast shows if it's, you know, like the Dean Martin variety show where it was like, yeah, these are a bunch of Hollywood people who all hang out at parties together.
And they know each other.
Yeah. And they're having, I want to watch them have a good time
but
together.
But it's interesting when people show up and they don't really know them, right?
Yeah.
And then like, but then you get like something that's the butt of the, like, didn't Ann Coulter show up to one? And
yeah,
like,
the new
just,
ones,
like,
the new ones they
made
do.
Fun of her, like,
the new ones they do are real weird, and they'll just like hire on comedians who have never met this person before. And like, and so, but the point is that like sometimes it's just, yeah, it's also just kind of sometimes okay to be like, yeah, I'm probably not going to do that show because that's just not in my skill set. Mm-hmm. Me writing jokes, making fun of another comedian that I don't know is not in my skill set. So he's asked me to do the show. We've talked about it. I've politely declined. And then this is kind of how it goes. Cause it's like, yeah, that's just not That's not a thing I can do. Mm.
One of our Feast of Fun regulars who's moved on, and he's a huge star now, Mateo Lane. I just stumbled upon this on the internet. He got on a Mexican talk show.
Ooh.
I had no idea Mateo was as fluent in Spanish as he is.
Yeah,
we could have done a podcast in Spanish with Mateo.
His family, he's half Mexican, half Italian. You knew that. That's why his real birth name is Matthew, I believe. But they all call him Mateo because like half his family is Latino.
And so he was on a Mexican talk show being interviewed by the talk show host, who is a clown named Platanito, which is slang for little dick.
Oh, yeah, because it's a little banana, right?
Yeah, it's a little banana. Little plantain.
Man, it's Buck Wild on late night over there, I guess.
I know. I was like, what? So we're having Mateo on the show to talk about how the hell did he wound up on Univision. Mm-hmm. So in part of the show, they had the hunk from the Drew Carey show and Mateo lip sync for their lives. And I won't tell you how it ends, but, you know, Mateo chose Mariah Carey's song. Mm. And the guy from Drew Carey, he chose What Does the Fox Say?
Oh, interesting.
So you can guess which one did better.
For Mexican television.
For Mexican television, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine which one it is.
But I just thought it was really remarkable, you know. And part of it is, like, Mateo's just doing really great. And people go, it's like, well, if I had his body, I would do this good. And I'm like, well, if you think that working out and getting, you know, a really muscular body will help you artistically, why aren't you doing it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did tell Mateo because he says when he moved to New York from Chicago, he was going to live in a 5-story walk up. I said, take a picture of your butt now and then take a picture after you've been living there for a year and see what the changes is. I don't know if he ever did it, but we'll find out.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll send us some butt photos.
And I think about like a lot of these Instagram studs who have millions of followers who put, and you know, I pulled up some of the weird sayings that they have and it's just like, a lot of it does sound like a lot of that Christian kind of, you know what I'm saying? Like it's
true, but it's also kind of come off as kind of vapid, right?
Right.
But every now and then you do come across one and be like, oh, that's a different way of thinking about things, right?
Sure. Yeah. I have a couple of quotes on my mirror in my bathroom.
Oh, really?
That are like inspirational kind of.
Well, what
are your mirror quotes?
One of them is from the Tao Te Ching. It's when something ends, it's a new beginning. Yeah. Kind of is one of those.
I took all of them down off the mirror.
No, the problem with having them on the mirror all the time is that I stop looking at them after a while. So it's a real problem. I got to figure out.
Well, let's examine some of these because I'm curious to hear your guys' thoughts on this.
Okay.
One is life doesn't give you what you want. It gives you what you deserve. It's so brutal.
That's terrible. What if you deserve cancer?
Yeah, that's that quote from Batman, I think.
You know?
Pain is weakness leaving the body.
Well, it's, you know, that's a quote that's been around for a long time, and it's meant to inspire you to be like, hey, listen, your experience of this, just go through it, because, like, you're strong, you can handle it.
Right.
You know,
you work until your idols become your rivals.
Ooh.
Ooh, girl. RuPaul, I'm coming after you, bitch. If you aren't begging for rest, then you're training your best.
I feel like you could play a really fun game show of is the quote I'm about to read something that I found on an inspirational blog or something a serial killer said in an interview once?
Fitness is not about being better than someone else. It's about being better than you used to be.
I like that.
I accept that one.
That's the whole, like, you're competing with yourself, not with others.
But the other thing, too, is, like, a lot of people get into fitness because they've had, like, a traumatic experience. Maybe they were into a car accident, so it's kind of, you know, where are you going from there? Sometimes it's just about maintaining.
Yeah.
Slowing the progress.
Two more. The train like a beast, look like a beauty. And the start is what stops most people. It's just overcoming the inertia of
the poetry of that. That's a snapper.
That's very true. A lot of times it's like when you go about doing something, the thing that's holding you back the most is your reticence in doing it. And if you just plunge forward, like they say, ain't nothing to it but to do it.
It's all right to not look like the girls in the magazines, but fortunately, I do.
Let's give a shout out to Jonathan, who's the oldest living creature, land creature, they say. 168 years old, tortoise, living on the island of St. Helena in the Atlantic.
And his name's Jonathan?
Jonathan, the longest living tortoise in the world. He's 186 years old, and they say he's gay. How do they know?
Wow.
Well, because he's never procreated, and he does have a companion, Frederica, who they thought it was. They introduced them in 1991, so it's a relatively new relationship, considering like he's, you know, since
maybe he's
like,
just tired,
you know, since he's 186 years old. But they just discovered that Frederica is actually Frederico, and they're companions, and they hang out and they eat stuff together.
Now the revelation of the famous turtle and his gay lover. Is just coming out as the island country they live in St. Helena, is debating marriage equality. Mm-hmm. Citizens have been asked to register their opinion on the issue by October 27th, and a Supreme Court hearing is expected in January.
Oh, my God. What timing?
What could go wrong when the public votes on civil rights?
Well, what did Napoleon think about same-sex marriage?
Because that's the island he died on.
Yeah, right? That's where he was exiled and died
Because first it was Elba, right? And then it was too close to France, so he came back.
Yeah.
And so when they got rid of him the second time, they're like, we're sending you all the way to the South Atlantic by Africa. But I also believe, like, it's a British protectorate now, too.
It's in the middle of fucking nowhere.
What if the tortoise killed him? Does that timeline work out? I can't remember when Napoleon died.
Late 1800s. Napoleon died in, like, 1820 or something like that, I would imagine.
No, late 1800s.
If he killed him, he did it really slowly.
Yeah, it would have been, like, mid-1800s, early 1800s, yeah.
Have you seen turtles fucking on
tortoises
YouTube?
Or turtles?
These big land, the old ones, yeah.
Yes.
They're like...
Yes, I have.
They're just insane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You thought you looked weird when you put your Snapchat.
Thank you. Yeah, that's why I got off Snapchat.
He died in 1821. This says he died actually in Brussels. Work out. That doesn't seem right.
Man, I was really hoping. Mm-hmm. Maybe he got sick and then they brought him back. I was really
wrong
hoping,
again, Wikipedia.
I was really hoping that the tortoise might have killed Napoleon. That would have been great.
So the reasons why they think that these turtles live such a long time is because they have a very slow development. And so they don't really reach maturity until much, much later in life. And so since they're still growing, they're not...
Right.
Dying. And they also also think because they have like they live in harsh environments, and so that's why they also have like those hard shells and everything. And so it takes them more time to
open
reproduce.
Up to people.
Yeah. And also too, they said that their diet, because it's full of like a lot of grains and antioxidants. So they're
telling me is that if I stay a child for a long time, have a hard shell and eat a lot of greens, that I can live forever.
Probably for a very, very long time.
All right, I'll take it.
Just don't let the devil get you fat.
No. The quickest way to stop is to start.
Well, the other thing too, these animals actually they fast for a long time. They go long periods of time without eating. So maybe that gets that growth hormone going.
And they're closer to Christ.
And they say most people that live for a very long time have a calorie restricted diet. So most people that are old, like the reason why they're little old ladies is because you know they're little.
Bill O'Reilly just settled his sexual harassment lawsuit or claim for $32 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Details of the lawsuit have come out and saying he was harassing one of his associates,
a colleague at Fox News,
by sending her gay porn.
Mm-hmm. And you're kind of like, what's the point of like, is it just harassment?
It was gay male porn.
Is it something
he's just a monster?
Is it something that's turning him on? Did he think it would turn her on? Is it just a way to be like, I'm fucking with you?
Was he saying like, I'm gonna fuck you this like this well hung man is fucking this other man?
I think for him, it's always just power and just being a dick, just a raging dick. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There was a fun stat going around on Twitter, and I feel bad that I can't remember the Twitter user's handle, so I'm sorry, but that $32 million, that Bill O'Reilly's settlement, he could have also purchased every single ticket to Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium, because that's the exact amount of money that it made as a movie. So... That's a fun fact. Yeah.
Is that the movie Heath Ledger did?
No, Dustin Hoffman.
Okay.
You're thinking of
Dr. Parnassus.
Dr. Parnassus, yeah, okay. Which was Parnassus. A Terry Gilliam film. Okay. No, Mr. McGorium's Wonder Emporium was Dustin Hoffman's children's movie that he wanted to make for his kids.
How the hell do you know that it made $32 million?
It was a Twitter fun okay. fact okay. that was going around. I just can't remember the user's name.
Mm-hmm. I mean, agreeing that mm-hmm. you pay $32 million is basically admitting you did something unspeakable.
Yeah, but you're forgetting that Bill O'Reilly rarely admits that he's done anything.
Yeah, they're not going to admit to that. And didn't, like, Fox News rehired him, right? They're like, you've settled this case now, and now you're rehired or something?
I know he's a guest on Hannity a lot. I don't know okay. if he got fully rehired. I think he might be coming... they might be, like, giving him contract work.
Because he was getting, like, $100 million a year or something, I think, yeah. at one point
He had the prime spot.
So you're like, if you're getting that much money, what's $32 million?
I mean, he also is still a bestseller. I mean, he had a book that was still in the New York Times bestseller list, I believe, when he got fired.
They're all monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and at the same time, you know, if you step back a little bit, the whole point of this Russian propaganda mm-hmm. and, you know, sort of takeover of our political system and social media is that they want us to fight with each mm-hmm. other, you know? Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I'm thinking, like, you know, is the solution to the way of getting out of this mess is necessarily like looking, you know, Bill O'Reilly and Harvey Weinstein are monsters, deplorable, and they should be removed immediately from their positions. And Trump. And at the same time, it's like, that's exactly also what Russians want us to do, is to fight with each other and just basically have grid, a social, cultural, political, economic gridlock in this country. Mm. That's their goal, ultimately. And so I'm wondering if maybe reaching out somehow to moderate people or to people that can be persuaded somehow is a better strategy. It's, you know, because I see so much of us, like, even fighting within our own community on social media, it's like, if you're not calling out racism amongst your drag queen peers, you're not doing it right. And I'm just kind of thinking, I was like, isn't it better just to, like, pick up the phone and talk to somebody as opposed to, like, publicly shaming them first?
People love a good mob. They mm-hmm. have a mob mentality. They all want to kind of pile on. And if you read, like, you know, The Crucible, or if you see the movie The Crucible, where they all, like, point at each other and accuse them all of witchcraft, and then it's like one person gets executed after another. And in some senses, it's a type of madness. Mm-hmm. And it's contagious. And you just kind of, like, all gang up on somebody. And I'm not saying that the initial thing's not wrong, but, like, there are ways to handle ways. These things, and it's not always just like this click mentality.
There's a lot of nuance that mm-hmm. the internet doesn't allow you to have, yeah. And a lot of that's mm-hmm. you know, human interaction and stuff. I've been working for a very long time on a project basically about Facebook rhetoric, which is covering a lot of this as well. Which is a lot of the problem you also have on the internet is that people aren't really actually engaged in debate with each other. They're just having the same fight they had with the last couple mm-hmm. people they talked to, because you'll see a lot of assumption of position, where somebody will start yelling at somebody about something they didn't actually say because the last couple people that mm-hmm. they argued with about this also believed that other thing. Mm-hmm. And this person's like, I never said anything about this. And it's just a presumption that starts happening. John Ronson wrote a book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, that's about this topic, and basically about how we've recreated the public stockades because it's a bad thing, but it's a really fun emotion mm-hmm. to righteously tear someone apart, because you get to do all of the, like, the murder instincts and those killer instincts that we have as, you know, animals, but you get to do it for what you consider a good cause. And that's a lot of what drives this, is people get to feel really good about doing this.
Stockade, yeah.
Well, Mark and I, you and I have been doing this podcast for 13, 14 years.
We'll be on our 14th year in January.
What? And through the decade, plural, and a half, almost, we've been on the receiving end of a lot of public shaming or prosecution.
Yeah, we get by, though. I have to say there's been some periods in our career where that certainly has been the case. But I'd say for the most part is, you know, we have a great audience who supports us, and, you know, a lot of them really love what we do. And so we've kind of been sheltered from a lot of that kind of abuse that other people get. But we have had it over certain periods of time. Yeah.
Is it mostly because we spend a lot of time cultivating that audience mm-hmm. and forming, like, deeper relationships with them, where mm-hmm. it's a relationship built on trust and not just mm-hmm. you know, on consumption,
right? Yeah. I had a similar problem because the Tomfoolery audience is great because it's a weird book podcast. So they're really awesome. I love them to death. We have a private group and people are really fun in there. I don't get to interact with them all the time, but I see what's going on in there. And then when I started doing YouTube stuff with my friend on another channel that was already established that had a completely different fan base, those people started like aggressively tearing me apart in different ways that I had just completely forgotten was was a reaction that could happen to me putting out things into the world because I had grown so comfortable with the Tomfoolery audience.
Sure.
But you really never lived until you see your fake home address being plastered on social media websites with calls to action to harm you.
Oh,
and you're just kind of like going, what is this all about? You know, and you go and you contact the moderators of that website and they just go, they respond with, well, you know, sometimes you have fans and sometimes you don't have fans. And, you know, I'm just like, this is a safety issue and they're attacking us. They're going to attack other people, you know, and part of it is part of me is just like, ultimately, it helps to have a P.O. box.
Yeah, I'm getting one when I move to L.A.
Don't put your home address there. And
well, it's great for deliveries, too.
Right.
And that way you can register every single thing you do on the internet to that P.O. box. And RuPaul put this out there, too, is like, if you can have a pseudonym or stage name, do so because people...
Yeah,
if there's a legal filing, your stuff goes out there.
Yeah,
Halloween's coming; it's right around the corner. Yeah, a lot of people go, a lot of kids go trick or treating, and they did a study on who spends the most money on per person in each state on candy.
Okay,
candy's big.
Candy's big. It's that's billions, why it's billions of dollars. And so each state, they did the thing. And so, what state do you think spends the least amount on Halloween candy?
The least.
The least.
Who's the healthiest state?
The most on...
Per capita.
Per capita.
Who eats the less candy during Halloween?
It's Maine.
I don't know if it's the less... Well, they just say like...
Who spends the least?
On average, Ohio spends about $11 on... Each person spends about $11 on Halloween candy. And in Oregon, they spend $40 per person.
Weird. Oregon was on my list of possible...
Healthy.
Short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that might also have to do with the generosity of the people. Because if you're spending a lot of money on candy, you're probably a very generous person. Or you have a lot of kids that you have to support. Like this neighborhood we live in, they bus kids in.
Right.
Because it's a nice neighborhood.
Right.
And there's the people usually give out like nice candy and they literally like they buy like 2,000 units.
Oh, wow.
And so like I have given out candy before and I was just like, I think I had like 300 or 400 pieces and I was just like, it was gone in no time at all. So I don't even do, I can't afford to give out Halloween candy. So I just turn off the lights and go someplace else.
I wish I could. I've lived, I've never lived in a building that had any sort of Halloween setup whatsoever, which is weird because I've always lived in like high rises that had families. Mm-hmm. And I even asked like the front desk in my apartment in Austin and the new apartment I live in right here. I've asked the front desk, like, hey, is there like a list of apartments? Because I know that some apartment buildings will do like a list where it's like the families, if they want to stay in the building, this is the list of apartments that are participating and handing out candy. Because I usually end up just watching movies and hanging out at home.
Well, we also live like in Lakeview, which is, you know, boys town. So I don't know how many families actually live in your building.
Well, I live on the lake, so I'm in the more like Jewish and young adult area. Ah. So there are kind of a couple.
Mark, just to clarify, I think you spent more Halloweens than not giving out modest amounts of candy. And the trick that we've discovered is slowly giving it to the kids to make it a little more theatrical
and more of a show,
you know, or you can be like the drunk monster that can't manage to put the candy in the bag for the kids. So the kids are always chasing, you know, it's like that Benny Hill, the drunk person can't put the straw in their mouth.
Or I'll get some bags of candy and then I'll go next door to the neighbors because they have more of a better place to kind of like give candy out.
But if you think that Halloween and the, I call it the candy cartels, Nestle, Mars, don't rule your economy and your politics, think about it this way. Daylight saving time is extended you ask yourself, when is daylight savings? The answer is always after Halloween. And the reason is, even though it would be better to have it a little bit sooner, is because candy manufacturers want that extra hour of daylight in the evening on Halloween night so they can make millions of dollars in selling candy.
Oh, that's smart. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, it always takes place. Daylight savings is always after Halloween. That's how so you can remember.
Because it's huge business. It is so much money. And then also, too, it's not only the money that they spend on the Halloween candy. It's on our obesity rates here in the United States cost us to buy more products and to spend more on health care. So it's part of the whole industrial military health care complex.
The military chocolate complex?
Yes.
Delicious but deadly. I want to do a shout out to the iPod. It's this week. It's the 16th anniversary of the iPod.
Oh, wow. You guys are almost as old as the iPod.
Almost.
So 3 years later, audio blogs started using the term podcast to refer to shows that could be synchronized with portable media players like iPods. Mm-hmm. Or you remember the... later, what is it? The Dell DJ was
the Zune too.
Zune came later.
I had a Rio.
Microsoft Zune.
I had a Rio. Yeah, I had a Rio. That's my first one.
We started this podcast really without the expectation of ever being able to be played on anything other than iPods. And part of it is because a lot of those MP3 players of the day, they could only hold about 40 megabytes of file space, and then came the 5 gigabyte iPod, which allowed you to have thousands of songs, but more importantly, dozens of podcasts.
Yeah.
And so Mark and I were just like, we started this podcast as a way to market this musical variety show that we're doing at the time called Feast of Fools. And we felt that we were really late into the game because when we launched our first episode in February 8th of 2005, there were 50 other shows out there, and we're like, there's no way. we've done, talked to thousands, literally, of guests, and grown into this format where it's friends sitting around informally talking about news, trends, and interviews and big ideas. And podcasts at that time, when we first started, were really audio blogs, whereas people at home reading their essays, it was like blogging for the blind. And so here we are, thanks to everybody and thanks to Cody and
thank you. You guys are almost legal in Arkansas.
So thanks for being a friend and a fan all these years, folks. Wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you guys. And really, it's an honor to continue to do the show because of your support.
And the best way to support the podcast is to become a Plus member. And you can do that at feastoffun.com/plus because your contribution, your subscription to the show is what makes this show happen. A lot of people had their renewals come up in October, and I want to thank you so much. But a few got declined because a lot of times people, like their credit card gets changed. So PayPal is for your protection. If you have a new credit card, they're not going to allow a subscription to go through. So if you had a subscription, please check on it through your PayPal. If you're having any problems, if you have any questions, please just email me at mail@feastoffun.com or contact me on Facebook and we can help get it sorted out because really we can't do the show without your support.
On Thursday, November the 9th, we're going to be at the Austin International Drag Festival doing a live podcast with Karen from Finance.
Yay! Australian drag queen.
Australian drag queen. Other famous drag queens I cannot announce because...
they're contractually obliged not to say anything.
But they're... let's just say they're,
up and coming.
Very popular queens.
And famous.
And so we're going to be doing that Thursday the 9th. If you want to get into the Austin International Drag Festival and not spend a lot of money, you can use the coupon code FEAST at checkout and get 25% off.
Ooh.
We don't make any money off of this. So we're just doing this as a gift to our friends and fans who live in Austin in Central Texas or are going to be coming down there. Use the code FEAST, 25% off. That's the only thing they're doing. Like, not everybody's getting this. So it's a special
thing. Get it while the getting's good.
And get it before they realize that, this is like they're giving away 25% of the ticket price. So get it now.
Cody, I want to wish you the best of luck on your move out to Los Angeles.
Thank you.
I hope your career goals get met.
I do as well. The cat and I are going to wear matching headscarves and sunglasses on the drive down. I'm really looking forward to it.
You're riding in a car with a cat?
Yeah.
I hope your cat has some good drugs.
He's got like a relaxation collar that I also might be wearing.
Aww.
What does a relaxation collar do?
It's like it emits pheromones that relaxes him.
That's a drag queen.
pheromones.
Pheromones.
Yes. Lots of highlight.
But yeah, it's going to be fun. Thank you. And I'll be back. So, you know, this isn't the last you've seen me.
Well, I look forward to your visits back to Chicago, Cody.
Thank you. I do as well.
You'll be like, I'll be back, bitches. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.